listening to The History of Religions and Their Gods, hosted by me, yours truly, the skeptical ghost heathen. Oh, you're definitely going to want a full can of poppycock for this one. Hello, heathens. Hey, welcome back to the show. Today is March 30th. 2023, and this is Chapter 5 of Season 6, The Sons of Thunder. Now, we are still making our way through Dennis MacDonald's book, The Homeric Epics and the Gospel of Mark. But the season name of the podcast, well, I'm calling it Mark's Homeric Epic and the Gospel of Odysseus. Now, in this episode, we will take a very close look at the twin brothers in Mark's story, 3:17. And that would be James and his identical twin, John. And see how they relate to the sons of Zeus, Castor and Pollux. Was Mark influenced by Homer's characters like he was with Odysseus and Hector? Well, there's only one way to find out. Let's dig in deep, guys. Let's go. Throughout the Gospel of Mark, James and John, who were supposedly the sons of Zebedee, joined Simon and sometimes Andrew to witness Jesus' most private and spectacular moments, such as his healing Simon's mother-in-law, or raising Jairus' daughter, which was a clever trope actually borrowed from the Two Kings narrative with Elijah, and his transfiguration, his predictions about the future on the Mount of Olives, and his agony at Gethsemane. The earliest author to write about Jesus after the War of 70, he renames three of the disciples, and only three. To Simon, he gives the name Peter. And to James and John collectively, he names them Boanerges. Or more appropriately, or more specifically, the Gods of Thunder. Now, this author consistently presents these brothers as absolute twins with no distinguishing traits at all between them. He referred to James 9 times, always as the first of the brothers. James and John, for an example, never John and James. John once appears without James in 9:38, but even then, he has no characteristics to distinguish him from his twin. Kind of like Tweedledum and Tweedledee. Whatever the brothers do, they always do together. Now, what's interesting here is that not one of the other later redactors gave them the same notoriety as Mark. In fact, for whatever reason, Matthew repeatedly deleted Mark's reference to them. And instead, he added only that their mother was one of the women at the empty tomb. And then same with Luke, who writes sometime after, often dropped the brothers when he was borrowing from Mark's gospel. But what he did do is add an important tale about them that will concern us a little bit later in the show. And despite its title, well, the Gospel of John never refers to John or James, though the epilogue does include the Sons of Thunder, who are among the disciples who went to Galilee to fish after the resurrection. but only in Mark. Jesus says that Jesus renamed them to Boanerges. Now Mark first mentions the brothers in the following passage.
As Jesus passed along the Sea of Galilee, he saw Simon and his brother Andrew casting a net into the sea, for they were fishermen. And Jesus said to them, "Follow me, and I will make you fish for people." And immediately they left their nets and followed him. As he went a little further, he saw James, the son of Zebedee, and his brother John, who were in the boat mending the nets. Immediately he called them, and they left their father Zebedee in the boat with the hired men, and they followed him.
So the sons of Zebedee left their father in the boat to become anglers of men, basically. But they frequently will sail the Sea of Galilee, all the way from chapter 3, all the way to chapter 8 in Mark. Now it's in Mark 3:17 where we will find the sons of Zebedee, renamed to, by Jesus, Boanerges. Or more appropriately, the sons of thunder. Now, from what we have gathered so far in Mark's narrative, Mark's readers would more than likely want to compare them to Castor and Polydeuces from Homer. In fact, in 1913, J. Rendell Harris, he published an extensive study that was entitled Boanerges, in which he suggests that the sons of Zebedee were Christianized heavenly twins, or avatars of the Dioscuri, Castor and Polydeuces. Now, the key to this identification is the word Boanerges, in which Mark translated into Greek as the sons of thunder. And in that one stroke of Mark's pen, he swept them out of whatever historic reality they might have actually had and right into a Greek literary myth. Why? Because Greeks knew Castor and Polydeuces as the sons of Leda by her husband Tyndareus, but also as the Dioscuri, a.k.a. Zeus's boys, or lads of Zeus. And among many of the god Zeus's epithets were the thunder, lightning, and the thundering one. His father, Cronos, bore the epithet father of thunder and lightning. And early as Homer, 800 BCE, both thunder and lightning were always taken as the signs of the god Zeus, who many scholars believe Yahweh was ultimately modeled after. Both sets of brothers in these stories were given the collective names that identified them as the sons of someone other than their biological father. And in both cases, the father was related to thunder and lightning. Now, according to Harris, the origins of Dioscurism lay in prehistoric astrology and superstitions concerning twins, celestial twins. He also argued for the ubiquity of the myth not only in ancient Greece and Rome, but also in Egypt, India, Palestine, Central Asia Minor, current-day Turkey, Syria, Australia, North and South America, Southeast Asia, and various other regions of Africa. So basically everywhere. And there's evidence of this myth being used among Christians, includes the depictions of Judas, Didymus, Thomas as Jesus' twin brother in the once lost but recently found 2nd century Acts of Thomas that were buried in the middle of the desert, and twinned saints of medieval Europe, and the cult of Santiago, which he held James to be the brother not of John, but of Jesus. So Jesus is naming the sons of Zebedee as the sons of thunder, argues Harris, is Mark's window to a landscape of early Christian Dioscurism. Now, unfortunately for Harris, he didn't investigate the implications of his own research, because he failed to notice that the name Boanerges would have actually alerted Mark's readers to the similarities between the brothers in Mark's tale to Castor and Polydeuces. Because Mark consistently presented the brothers of Zebedee as Christianized Dioscuri, and more than likely expected or hoped that his readers would interpret them that way as well. The Homeric hymns that were dedicated to the Dioscuri around the 6th and 7th century BCE established this pattern. And I begin a quote.
Bright-eyed muses, tell of the Tyndaridae, the sons of Zeus, glorious children of neat angled Leda, Castor the tamer of horses, and blameless Polydeuces. When Leda had lain with the dark-clouded son of Cronos, she bare them beneath the peak of the great hill Taygetus. Children who are deliverers of men on earth, and of swift-going ships when stormy gales rage over the ruthless sea. Then the shipmen call upon the sons of the great Zeus, with valves of white lambs, going to the peak of the stern. But the strong wind and the waves of the sea lay the ship underwater, until suddenly these two are seen darting through the air on tawny wings. Forthwith they allay the blast of the cruel wind and still the waves upon the surface of the white sea. Fair signs are they and deliverance from toil. And when the shipmen see them, they are glad and have rest from their pain and labor.
Now, ancient sailors interpreted St. Elmo's fire, which was related to electrically generated sparks that would light up the mast of a ship before a storm came, as epiphanies of the Dioscuri. And how fortunate for Jason that his Argonauts included Castor and Polydeuces, who prayed to their thundering sire for safety at sea. That would be Zeus. Now, according to Wikipedia, St. Elmo's Fire isn't just an 80s TV show. It's also called Witch Fire, or Witch's Fire, which is a weather phenomenon in which luminous plasma is created by a corona discharge from a rod-like object, such as a mast of a ship, a church steeple, a spire, a chimney, or even an animal horn, in some atmospheric electrical charge. It has also been observed on the leading edges of airplanes, as in the case of British Airways Flight 009. And the intensity of the effect is a blue or violet glow around the object, often accompanied by a hissing or buzzing sound. Now, just like James and John from Mark's tale, they too were sailors. They also fished from their father's boats. And both sets of brothers had collective names that were related to two different fathers. For example, James and John were sons of Zebedee, as well as the name that Jesus gave them, Boanerges, sons of thunder. And Castor and Polydeuces were sons of Tyndareus, as well as Dioscuri, also known as the boys of Zeus. Later periscopes and Mark parody the Dioscuri in their Boanerges disguise. Mark's next explicit reference to the brothers is Jesus' selection of them, along with Peter, to witness his revival of Jairus' daughter, which I'll talk about a little later in the episode, because the entire Jairus narrative was borrowed from 2 Kings, and we'll do that at the end of the episode. Now, the Greek author for Mark won't mention the brothers again until after the Transfiguration narrative.
6 days later, Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John and led them up high mountains apart by themselves. And he was transfigured before them, and his clothes became dazzling white, such as no one on earth could bleach them. And there appeared to them Elijah with Moses, who were talking with Jesus.
Chapter 9, verses 2 through 4. So, the presence of James and John at the Transfiguration, it actually helps explain their unusual request in chapter 10, verses 35 through 40, when Mark refers to the brothers again, and the only time he does so without the presence of Simon Peter. So here, once again, the brothers are indistinguishable. In fact, they even speak in unison. And in quotation,
James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came forward to him and said to him,
Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you.
And he said to them, What is it
that you want me to do for you?
And they said to them,
Grant us to sit, one at your right hand and the other at your left hand, in your glory.
Chapter 10, verses 35 to 37. The brothers had seen Jesus glorified at the Transfiguration, and now wanted the same glory for themselves. Now, curiously, folks, they seem not to care which one of them got to sit on the right or on the left hand of Jesus in his glorification. Though the right hand was always the seat of the greater glory, as seen in 1236, 1462, and 16:5 as an example. So the request to Jesus suggests they were not competing with each other, just with other disciples. At least, this is how it looked to the other 10. Now, as portrayed in art form from the Roman imperial period, the Dioscuri commonly appeared on the right and left-hand side of enthroned deities. And typically, a star would be above the head of each brother to symbolize their heavenly glorification, just like Christians would adopt a ring centuries later. And almost always, the brothers mirrored each other in every single instance without any distinguishing traits, making it damn near impossible to know which one is which. And there are Greek coins that also show them on either side of the god Serapis. And that same scene is also shown on a Greek gem. Other gems place the brothers to the right and left-hand side of the god Zeus. And Roman art also places these castors on the right and the left of the god Serapis, the Mithraic Aeon, Saturn, Mars, Juno, and Jupiter. So Mark's readers would naturally have picked up on the request of the Sons of Thunder, a request for glorification like that of the Sons of Zeus. Now in Mark's story, Jesus responded, You do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink, or be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with? Now, the symbols of the cup and the baptism is more than likely, at least in Mark's mind, it represents to suffer with Jesus, having the same suffering. So the brothers both answered simultaneously, We are able. So Mark's readers soon will learn that despite their statement and later their alignment with Peter's willingness to die with Jesus, they would not be able to follow him to his death after all. They instead, like the rest of the disciples, would all take off, running and hide at his arrest. Now, this is also the way that Mark employs the reversal of expectation, which he constantly employs in his gospel. And he does it again here too, because similarly, Simon Peter would not be able to carry Jesus' cross, as Jesus had commanded in 8:34, and as Peter had promised in 14:31. Instead, it would be his namesake, Simon of Cyrene, someone else altogether. Reversal of expectation. Additionally, James and John would not be able to drink Jesus' cup or be baptized with his baptism, that is, to die alongside him. Instead, what do we get? Instead, we get two thieves that would be crucified next to him, on his left and on his right. Now, I think this author sharpened the tragedy by having these three disciples accompany Jesus at the raising of Jairus' daughter, the Transfiguration, the prophecies on the Mount of Olives, and the Agony at Gethsemane. But when they should have accompanied Jesus to his death, they failed to do so. They all ran and hid. Now the continuation of Jesus' response to the Sons of Thunder twins, with its subtle change of tense, it indicates that even though the brothers were unable to follow Jesus to his cross, someday they would suffer for him, and sometime in the future. And the quote says, The cup that I drink, you will drink, and with the baptism with which I am baptized, you will be baptized. But to sit at my right hand and my left hand is not mine to grant, but it is for those from whom it has been prepared. Chapter 10, verse 39 to 40.
Now, on the surface level, this passage seems to predict the martyrdoms of the sons of Zebedee. And it's actually prompted scholars to argue that both brothers had indeed died as martyrs, and prior to the composition of this earliest gospel. Because according to the spurious book of Acts, 12:2, dated sometime around 90, even 110 of the Common Era, it was actually Herod Antipas who purportedly executed James, the brother of John, with a sword. But neither Acts nor any other text of the New Testament mentions a martyrdom of John, ever. So furthermore, Jesus' prediction that James and John would both drink Jesus' cup and be baptized with his baptism never generated apocryphal traditions concerning his martyrdom. However, the Acts of John, a second century Christian apocrypha, dated sometime around 130 the Common Era, claimed that the apostle died at the ripe old age and never suffered a martyrdom at all. The Gospel of John, which is also a second century Christian production that was canonized along with Mark, but closer to 130, 150 CE, if not later. But the conclusion of this gospel, it tried to correct the tradition that John would not die a martyr's death. Now this author, or these authors apparently, thought that some people might view the recent death of the disciples as disconfirmation of Jesus' promise that John would survive the parousia, or the second coming. But the dominant ecclesiastical tradition held that John took up residence at Ephesus, and the oldest of the original disciples, who died just by natural causes. Now, the author for Mark may have shared the same notion that this disciple should not die before the return of Jesus in his story. Because earlier in his tale, Jesus had told the 12, "There are some standing here who will not taste death until they see that the kingdom of God has come with full power." Now, some interpreters of this passage suggest that this refers to Jesus' glorification on the Mount of Transfiguration that immediately follows. But for Mark, the transfiguration of Jesus would hardly qualify as the coming of the kingdom of God. One should probably read this prediction along with the preceding verses, which actually predicts the coming of the Son of Man, and with another prediction in 13:10, and I quote, "that this generation will not pass away until all these things have come to pass." Now, indeed, these two verses are remarkably similar in their wording. Mark 13:30 obviously does not refer to the transfiguration, but to the parousia, which is the return. So it would seem reasonable to assume that this generation would include one or more of the disciples who would not taste death until they see that the kingdom of God has come with power. Now, in his predictions to Peter, Andrew, James, and John, Jesus warned that they will be beaten in synagogues and will stand before governors and kings. He says that they will be hated by all, but the one who endures to the end will be saved. Yes, Mark's a smart guy here. So this last phrase, it's also notoriously obscure, because most scholars take it to mean that anyone who endures the anticipated persecution of Christianity and does it perfectly, or until their death, will be rewarded with life everlasting. But the Greek here can also mean to the end of war. Not just any war, the war. In other words, if someone can survive the war between the Jews and the Romans of 66 to 70 CE and does so with faith in Jesus, that they will escape imminent death, just like the 1 million Jews. That is the true message of what Mark meant by salvation. Now, just like Mark, written well after the fall of Jerusalem in 70 CE, 4 Ezra contains a similar promise, and it reads like this, "And it shall be that whoever remains after the catastrophes I have told you will be saved and will see my salvation and the end of my world." That's found in 4 Ezra 9, 7 through 8. So if one were to read Mark with the same sentiment, Jesus' prediction that the one who endures until the end will be saved refers to anyone who is a believer in Jesus, who is the pathway to peace, and survived the war because they didn't fight in the war with the rebels. Now John, he surely is the best candidate for the one among the 12 who would not taste death before seeing the arrival of the kingdom of God, who would be a literary representative of the generation that would not pass away before the coming of the Son of Man. Now, in the Homeric theory, if this author for Mark thought that John would not die, then what did he mean by Jesus' prediction that James and John would drink Jesus' cup and be baptized with his baptism? Because some scholars have read this prediction as a reference merely to the Eucharist and the baptism. But I prefer the interpretation of John Chrysostom, who thought Jesus' cup and baptism actually referred to death, even though John did not die as a martyr. And in quotation, "For James was beheaded by a sword," as seen in Acts 12:2, "and John died many times." Now, obviously, John did not die as a martyr several times, but traditionally, he did often suffer. And the evidence cited here suggests, though it cannot be proven, that when Mark composed his gospel, the two sons of Zebedee had radically different lifespans. James was the first of the 12 to die, but his brother thought to never die. In this respect, too, the Boanerges do parallel the Dioscuri. Now, I'm guessing that when this author for Luke composed the book of Acts sometime after 90, perhaps even 100, he needed James to die and for John to live on, more than likely to serve this literary purpose, even though other apocryphal books will kill him off. In some stories, he just simply ascends up to heaven. And then the church father Tertullian, well, he has him boiled in oil, but he escapes unscathed. Otherwise, both brothers get to live on, and that's through all four biblical narratives. Now, let's take a look at this a little bit closer. So Tyndareus, well, basically he sired Castor, but Zeus had sired Polydeuces. Castor, therefore, was mortal, and Polydeuces was immortal. And in a fight, Castor died. So Polydeuces profoundly loved his brother so much that he went to Zeus and asked him to slay him, because he had no desire to live without his twin brother. And Zeus then offered Polydeuces the chance to share a single immortality with Castor. Now, according to some authors, Pindar, an ancient Greek lyric poet from Thebes, he says, "In alternate changes, the twin brothers spend one day beside their dear father, Zeus, and the other down in the hollow earth." Now, more popular was the notion that on alternate days, one brother was alive while the other was dead, according to Lucian in the Dialogue of the Gods. So the martyrdom of James, as found in Acts, also corresponds to the death of Castor. And the longevity of John is seemingly very similar to that of Polydeuces. Now, first, the typical order of the naming of the brothers seems to place the slain brother's name first, Castor, and then Polydeuces. Likewise, James, and then John, even though the second brother is the more exalted one of the two, which is probably Mark's typical reversal of expectation that he employs all throughout his gospel. Now, the Boanerges, like the Dioscuri, well, they wanted to make a special arrangement for the hereafter. They wanted to cut a deal with Jesus. They didn't ask to share a single immortality. Rather, they wanted equal glory, where they both get to sit on either side of Jesus on a cloud up in heaven. Now, their brotherly love may actually explain why they seem not to have cared who got to sit on the more prestigious right-hand side. Now, let's talk about Zeus. He granted the request of Polydeuces, whereas Jesus rejected the request of James and John, because they were asking for honors that weren't his to grant. So Mark didn't just mimic and copy the Dioscuri. Instead, he transvalued or emulated them with his famous reversal of expectations. Jesus refused a request of the sons of thunder for eternal honor, insisting instead on the importance of suffering. Now, Mark's readers, they would understand this, especially when they looked at, side by side, Castor and Polydeuces to James and John. Now, let's go ahead and take a look at these side by side. Castor and Polydeuces, well, they're sons of Tyndareus, where James and John are sons of Zebedee. Castor and Polydeuces, also known as the Dioscuri, or the Lads of Zeus, where James and John also have another name, Boanerges, or the Sons of Thunder. Castor and Polydeuces were Argonauts, nautical heroes. James and John were fishermen. Castor died in a violent death. James died a violent death. Polydeuces could have lived forever. John was thought to live until the Parousia, the return. Polydeuces asked Zeus if he and Castor could share a single immortality. Where James and John asked to sit at Jesus' right and left hand side in his glory. Zeus consented. Jesus refused. It's actually really interesting, because even the author for Luke clearly recognized James and John as avatars of the heavenly twins of Zeus. Even though he didn't like the idea and deleted all of Mark's reference to them as the Sons of Thunder, as well as their request for the seats at the right left-hand side of the enthroned Jesus up in the celestial city. Now this author, he was well aware and knew the traditions about the Dioscuri, not just because he was an educated Greek Jew, but when he composed Acts 28, he wrote that Paul's ship from Malta to Puteoli bore the sign of the Dioscuri. And nowhere else does he ever mention the insignia of ships, so why would he do it now? So by referring to the Dioscuri here in Acts 28, he seems to anticipate Paul's safe journey, as though under the safe protection of the twins, the Sons of Thunder. Now, the following passage that I'm about to read is the only contribution of Luke's gospel to traditions that concern the sons of Zebedee. Otherwise, he wipes them out entirely. And it conforms to yet another aspect of the myth of the Dioscuri. And it reads like this. When the days drew near for him, Jesus, to be taken up, he set his face to go to Jerusalem. And he sent messengers ahead of him. On their way, they entered a village of the Samaritans to make ready for him. But they did not receive him, because his face was set towards Jerusalem. When his disciples, James and John, saw it, they said, Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them? But Jesus turned and rebuked them. Luke 9:51-55. Now, there is a textual variant that adds to the question of James and John, as Elijah did, right? Certainly, the reference to fire from heaven is nearly identical to what Luke borrowed from the Septuagint in 2 Kings 1:10 and 12, where the prophet Elijah calls down heavenly fire to consume the soldiers that were sent by King Ahaziah. Now, surely, it is possible to regard this passage as an adaption from the story of Elijah, just as the scribe responsible for the variant did when editing Luke in later centuries. But Luke's appreciation to 2 Kings does not explain why he chose James and John to fill that narrative. I mean, why not Peter or any of the other disciples? Why choose the sons of Zebedee to call down the fire from heaven, a.k.a. the Sons of Thunder, with great allusions to the Lads of Zeus, who is the god of thunder and lightning? Luke's fire raining down from heaven is obviously an allusion to lightning and thunder, which is an appropriate weapon for who else? But the Sons of Thunder, perhaps. Jesus seems to have supposed that they actually possessed the power to destroy the village with this lightning and thunder if they wanted to. Jesus rebuked them for not presuming to have powers that they did not have, but for their lack of compassion. Jesus dissuaded them from being city sackers like the Dioscuri, or perhaps Vespasian and his son Titus. A clever illusion of Jesus rebuking the real Roman city sackers who leveled Jerusalem.
Castor and Polydeuces were known as the leprosi,
taken in antiquity to mean sackers of loss.
Better known and celebrated in art and dance was their sacking of the ancient Greek city of Aphidna. While Helen, the sister of the Dioscuri, when she was a child, Theseus abducted her and took her to Aphidna and guarded her with many soldiers. But despite how many guards he had, the Dioscuri was able to rescue their sister and then devastated the city with fire and thunder. It's probably no coincidence that this gospel's only contribution to traditions concerning James and John put them in a role consistent with that of the heavenly twins. Hey guys, I'm not done yet. I promised you earlier in the episode that I wanted to talk about the raising of Jairus' daughter in Mark and how he borrows it from an episode from 2 Kings with Elijah. And with the use from Targums, which are basically these translations of the Hebrew Bible into Aramaic, and they're really loosely written. I mean, where these authors of the first century were kind of like taking a hippie stance on it, if you would, you know, changing the interpretation of it. This is what it really means, and actually changing out some of the words, or, you know, or changing out a phrase. And we know that Mark used these targums because he used a phrasing, not of the Septuagint, but he took the words of Elijah's mouth from the targum, from the loose translation. So Mark's story is obviously a fictional story, when we talk about Jesus resurrecting this girl. And it's the story's in Mark 5:41. And Mark repeats these magical words of Jesus in Aramaic from the Targum, Talitha koum, and translates them into Greek as, "Girl, rise!" Now, we can slightly wonder if he had adapted those words from a Targum, just as he did with Psalms 22 and several other passages. Now, certainly Jesus never actually spoke those words, since the story is entirely fiction, because that tale, in fact, was a rewrite of another mystical story told in Elisha and Elijah, in 2 Kings 4:17, 37, which illustrates another way that Mark fabricated his material. Now, let's talk about the story, because in that story, a woman of Shunem, meaning double resting place in Hebrew, where Elisha often would take his rest, as seen in 2 Kings 4, 8-11. Coincidental names being a common trope, a common marker of myth-making, of course, seeks out the miracle-working Elisha and begs him to resurrect her son. And she goes looking for Elisha outdoors and sees him, and she falls to his feet, begging for his help. Then someone checks on the boy and confirms that he is indeed dead. But Elisha is not deterred, and he goes into her house himself and performs his magic, by word and by touch, resurrecting the dead boy. Now in Mark's version, found in Mark 5:22 through 43, well, the same thing happens. The character's name is Jairus, and he comes looking for Jesus, and he falls down to his feet, and he begs him for his help. Someone then confirms his daughter is, in fact, dead, but Jesus is not deterred, and goes himself into the petitioner's house and works his magic, just like Elisha did in 2 Kings, by word and by touch, and ultimately resurrecting the girl. Some elements have been conspicuously reversed in Mark's version, producing even more telltale coincidences. For instance, instead of a woman begging for her son, a man comes begging for his daughter. While in the Old Testament, an unnamed woman comes from an unnamed town, and the man's name Jairus, which literally means awaken, or bring to light, or enlightenment, or awake in Hebrew. Thank you. This, my friends, has been a Skeptical Ghost Heathen production.